It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. Lots to talk about. 1 week into the January Patch Tuesday update. Steve says it's decidedly a mixed blessing. There's a new router exploit that's going to get you to want to reboot your router. And then a step-by-step examination of a real-world zero-day log for J exploit. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 854, recorded Tuesday, January 18th, 2022. Anatomy of a Log4j Exploit. Security Now is brought to you by New Relic. That next 9 p.m. call is just waiting to happen. Get New Relic before it does, and you can get access to the whole New Relic platform and 100 gigabytes of data free forever. No credit card required. Sign up at newrelic.com/securitynow. And by Thinkst Canary. Detect attackers on your network while avoiding irritating false alarms. Get the alerts that matter. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. And by Collide. Get endpoint management that puts the user first. Visit Collide, KOLIDE.com/twit to learn more and activate a free 14-day trial right now. No credit card required. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your safety, security, privacy online with the man in charge, Steve Gibson. Hello, Steve.
For the 854th time.
Wow.
You know, we're getting the hang of this, Leo. It's like, okay, just increment the counter, okay, add 7 to the day of the month unless it wraps, and off we go.
In fact, I can almost always go, oh, there'll be Microsoft Patch Tuesday exploits.
That's right.
There'll be something wrong here, some ransomware there. You can it writes itself, Steve.
You're right. What am I doing here?
Please, you don't get out of it. No way.
So we're going to start off by looking at how, well, I should say, this is episode 854 for the 18th of January. The anatomy of a log4j exploit. We're going to start off by looking at how the U.S. Pentagon is dealing with log4j and how the U.S. administration at the White House wants to improve the security of open source software. This being, as you said, Leo, the third Tuesday of the month, we'll be looking back at last week's, once again, unfortunately, decidedly mixed blessing Patch Tuesday, the good and the bad. We'll then look at a very serious new remotely exploitable problem which affects millions of popular routers and provide a shortcut of the week to immediately check everyone's own router to see whether they might be vulnerable to this. And if so, just unplug.
It's
bad. And then over a new and very welcome access control standard being introduced by the W3C, which Chrome is already in the process of adopting. We'll talk about that. This is really a nice piece of technology. We'll wrap up the top portion of the podcast with yet another set of very serious WordPress add-on blunders. I think it was 84,000 sites affected.
Yikes.
Now.
Yikes.
It's like, oh, goodness. We're going to share a little bit of listener feedback, including answering the very popular questions about how to refill empty SodaStream tanks.
Turns out the topic of the week last week.
It was. You and I just briefly mentioned it in passing. I got swamped in Twitter. It's like, what? You can do that? How do you do that? So we'll talk about that. And then after a brief SpinRite progress update, we'll take a look at the inside of the operation of an actual Iranian log4j exploit kit.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I think a fun podcast for our listeners.
All right.
And of course, an engaging picture of the week.
Yes, I love it. You know, this is the geekiest show we do. I just love the level of, well, you'll see when you see the picture. picture of the week. I just love it. I just love it. Actually, we know there are a lot of people who listen to this show who are engineers and IT persons, sysadmins, and those sort of people. And I want to talk to you specifically, software engineers, sysadmins. If you know what the scenario I'm about to describe. You just got in bed. Maybe you even had an hour or two sleep. It used to be a pager. Now it's, your phone or your alerts or your DevOps beeper, whatever it is you've got, goes off. Something's not working. Your mind is racing. What could be wrong? Is it the back end? Is it the front end? Is it a global problem? Is it a server problem? Is it us? Is it them? Is it the network? Is it the cloud provider? Do we have slow-running queries on the MongoDB? Did I push a bug in my last deploy? You know what I'm talking about. The mind just goes round and round and round. And now, of course, your whole team is scrambling. You're tool to tool trying to message each other, trying to figure out what the hell's going on. That's the story if you don't have New Relic. Now, about half of you, actually, I saw a study from New Relic that said only half of all organizations have implemented observability for their networks and systems. Those are the people who don't get those 3 a.m. calls, or when they do, they go, they look at the New Relic dashboard, they go, oh, yeah, shoot, let me pull that back and push this out, or let me call Joe up at ops and have him flip the switch, or whatever it is, and it's fixed and you're back to bed. That's kind of how you want it set up. You need observability. This New Relic report showed how maintaining network observability is a big issue for companies all over the world, but not if you have New Relic. New Relic is actually 16 different monitoring products. They started Ruby on Rails when I first became aware of them, but they've so far gone beyond that. These are monitoring programs you might get separately, but you'd like them all in one place so that your team has full stack observability. And these things just do it. I'll give you some examples. If you've got an application, you'll definitely want to use their APM, their application monitoring. Unified monitoring for apps and microservices that even knows, it goes down, it has the symbol table, it knows the line of code. It could say, oh, here's a procedure that broke. You must have just pushed this, fix it. That kind of thing. Are you using Kubernetes? You'll love Pixie, instant Kubernetes observability. There's distributed tracing, so you can see all your traces without any management headaches. Find and fix issues fast. There's network performance monitoring, of course. Stop guessing where the performance issues start. Ditch those data silos for a system-wide correlated view. And that's just 4 of the 16 tools. It's amazing. Pinpoint issues down to the line of code, down to the node, down to the router. Know exactly why the problem happened, what happened, why it happened, and resolve it right away. This is why 14,000 companies, including DoorDash and GitHub, Epic Games, use New Relic to debug and improve their software, to monitor their performance, to make sure their stack is up and running. And if it's not, how to fix it fast. So whether you run a cloud-native startup or a Fortune 500 company, it takes 5 minutes to set up New Relic in your environment, and I've saved the best for last. It's free. This is not some trial offer. You get access to the entire New Relic platform and 100 gigabytes a month of data, free forever. You don't even give them a credit card, so they couldn't charge you if they wanted to, but they don't, because they know you're going to love it and you're going to use it more and more, and pretty soon you're going to say, I want more. But I'm telling you, use it free right now, every single one of those monitoring tools and 100 gigabytes of data, which I said, is that a lot per month? Is that a lot? And they said, yeah, that's actually a pretty hefty operation. You would know. It's a lot. It's not like some, here, have a cup of tea. You want the whole bag? Oh, well, that's enough. No, and no credit card required. If I were you, you don't have to ask the boss. I would just go newrelic.com/security now and do it. Install it right now. NEWRELIC.com/security now. That next 9 p.m. call is just waiting to happen. Get New Relic before it does. And if you don't, when you get that 9 p.m. call next week, Think of me, will you? New Relic and New Relic, of course. NewRelic.com/security. Now, you need this thing. You want this thing. Go get it. It's free. No credit card needed. New Relic. All right. I have a picture of the week that made me laugh out loud. I love this.
So, yes, for those who are not looking at the screen or the show notes, this begins with the inspiration from the flag of Norway, which is set against a red field. And basically it has what looks like, well, when you see it, sort of like two wires crossing perpendicularly, and they're insulated by some whiteness. Anyway, somebody realized, well, we could do some other flags. For example, you could have the, instead of Norway, you could have Andway, where, you know, those who are familiar with logic diagrams would replace the crossed wires with an AND gate. Of course, then that would lead to Nandway, XOR-way, X-Norway, if you invert the output of the XOR-way, and of course, Notway. And having looked at those, I realized, well, it's really too bad that we began with Norway.
Nor should have Nor, right?
Because, I mean, that's a NOR gate.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but yeah. No. That was the inspiration, so we're leaving that one alone.
And by the way, that AND gate is the inspiration for the TWIT logo.
Ah, the TWIT logo,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's so very cool.
There you go. All right.
Yeah. Okay, so hack the Pentagon with Log4j. At the end of last year, 2021, the Pentagon pivoted its ongoing Hack the Pentagon bug bounty program, which we've talked about years ago. I think it was 2016 that they launched it. And that's something that's being managed through HackerOne, through the HackerOne program, as opposed to like trying to do it in-house, which I think was a good idea. They pivoted, not surprisingly, to track down Log4j vulnerabilities on, you know, what amounted to potentially thousands of public-facing military websites. This was the first time that the U.S. Department of Defense had marshaled the ethical hacker community to tackle an emerging digital crisis in essentially real time. So, you know, normally it's just sort of like, oh, well, if you find something and you're pre-qualified, remember that I think they have 50, something like 50 vetted cybersecurity researchers. They're, you know, they're not like saying anybody anywhere come hack us. That'll probably get you in trouble. You need to be pre-approved. So just after days from the time that the public was made aware of the Log4j problem, the branch of the DOD known as the Defense Digital Service, or DDS, in connection with HackerOne, who, as I said, manages the department's bug bounty program, had broadened the scope of the ongoing competition to, you know, for testing their own systems and software. Katie Olson, the director of the DDS, told The Record that, quote, it was a really quick effort and a really elegant solution to use a contract that we already had in place with the crowdsource research community to very quickly do a scan of what might be affected within the DOD. Okay, so as a result, the roughly 50, as I said, previously vetted cybersecurity researchers who were already participating in the existing hunt were given the additional assignment to scour all .mil websites and report any potential weaknesses or exploits caused by the Log4j vulnerability. This on-the-fly change that is in their targeting coincided with the decision we talked about last week by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, whose own bug bounty program was just in the process of being launched, to similarly broaden the scope of its own bug search. Major tech companies and federal officials, also have scrambled to grasp the full extent of the Log4j flaw, warning that potentially, as we know, hundreds of millions of devices around the globe could be compromised. The CISA, C-I-S-A, last month issued an emergency directive requiring all civilian federal agencies to mitigate the threat. As I've often joked, no Christmas until you do, even though Christmas did happen on schedule. Though top agency officials on last Monday, repeated that they have not seen a malicious actor use the vulnerability to breach federal departments and agencies. At the same time, there's the expectation that if that had been done, it would be, you know, definitely kept on the down low. During a conference call with tech reporters, Eric Goldstein, who's the CISA's Executive Assistant Director for Cybersecurity, stated that the effort had already, that is the government's effort, had uncovered 17 previously unidentified assets that were vulnerable to Log4j. All, Eric said, which were remediated before any intrusion could occur. He added that, quote, it demonstrated the extraordinary power crowdsourcing brings to the research community to help not only the U.S. government, but the broader nation to find vulnerabilities before adversaries can abuse them, unquote. So anyway, although the Pentagon was already using an ecosystem of passive scanning software and technology to continuously monitor its assets, as we know, Log4j differs from previous cyber incidents by not centering around specific types of hardware or software, you know, like VPNs or firewalls. The trouble was, at the time of its initial disclosure, there was no mature automated solution available to track down, locate, and verify exploitable vulnerabilities. A guy named Lance Cleghorn, who's a digital services expert at the DDS, told The Record, he said, that's where the crowd really comes in to save the day. They can not only tell you, hey, I actually went and found this and it's vulnerable, like for sure, they're able to also say, here's the evidence and it's exploitable and that's a problem. So at first blush, public-facing military websites may not seem like an attractive target for hackers. Again, you do risk bringing down the wrath of the U.S. government and the DOD. However, there's long been a concern within the DOD that a sophisticated threat actor could use a previously unknown vulnerability to penetrate its network. Yeah, like anybody on the net should be worried, and to gain a foothold in the department's systems. And there is that massive non-classified Internet Protocol Router network known as NIPR, N-I-P-R net, literally stands for Non-Classified Internet Protocol Router Network. HackerOne's CISO, and who also calls himself the chief hacking officer, Chris Evans, said that once the bug bounties were expanded to explicitly include Log4j, hackers, quote, responded immediately and competently, with numerous valid reports pouring in within the first few hours of that explicit expansion. The DDS paid competitors $500 per discovered vulnerability and an additional $500 if proof of exploitability was also provided. And I don't know, Leo, you know, given the amount of money that the U.S. has, every time I look at those numbers, that
seems so cheap, doesn't it?
It does. Yes. It's like if you're serious about getting these problems rooted out, you know, a couple grand at least, you know,
yeah,
really.
I agree.
Wow. However, neither Katie Olson nor Lance Cleghorn, both at the DDS, were willing to disclose how many vulnerabilities had been found during the retooled bug bounty. Lance did say, we've paid out a chunk. Okay, but
again, well, a whole $700.
Exactly.
A lot of money.
Exactly. And Katie hopes that even more U.S. government agencies will move to establish their own bug bounty programs. You know, it does require some focus, but one would hope that they already have, you know, they've already got to have IT, right? And they've got to have security people. If they don't, they've got bigger problems. So how tough can it be to establish a relationship with HackerOne? And just, you know, copy what the DHS and the DOD have done. It's been done, right? There's already agreements and contracts in place. Just change the heading on the top of the page and get the other agencies going. I can't understand why they wouldn't have done that already. Speaking of the U.S. government, and specifically the White House, last Thursday, the 13th, the Biden administration convened what they called the Open Source Software Security Summit, having the stated goal of getting public and private sector organizations to rally their efforts and resources with the aim of securing open source software and its supply chain. Okay. Good goal. Although not only about Log4j, Log4j was the clear catalyst behind the summit. In the public sector, the list of participants pretty much was the who's who, including the Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emerging Technology. That's a department. That was Ann Neuberger, National Cyber Director Chris Inglis, officials from the Office of the National Cyber Director, Office of Science and Technology Policy, the Department of Defense, the Department of Commerce, the Department of Energy, the Department of Homeland Security, the Cyber Security and Infrastructure Security Agency, of course, the CISA, the NIST, and the NSF. The private sector was well represented by Akamai, Amazon, Apache, Apple, Cloudflare, Facebook/Meta, GitHub, Google, IBM, the Linux Foundation, the Open Source Security Foundation, I didn't know there was one. Good. Microsoft, Oracle, Red Hat, and VMware. The participants focused their attention onto three topics. First, preventing security defects and vulnerabilities in open source software, I guess. Good. Let's do that. Improving the process for finding security flaws and fixing them. And third, shrinking the time needed to deliver and deploy fixes. All worthy goals. The White House's After Action report wrote, quote, "Most major software packages include open source software, including software used by the national security community. Open source software brings unique value and has unique security challenges because of its breadth of use and the number of volunteers responsible for its ongoing security maintenance." So this sounds a little bit like what the FTC, we talked about last week, what they said. I mean, they did appreciate the particular challenges it represented because it was not commercial. It was all free and just done by random people. During the summit, Google proposed the creation of a new organization that would act as a marketplace for open source maintenance that would match volunteers from participating companies with critical projects that need the most support. Kent Walker, Google's president of global affairs and chief legal officer, both for Google and Alphabet, he was quoted saying, quote, "For too long, the software community has taken comfort in the assumption that open source software is generally secure due to its transparency and the assumption that many eyes were watching to detect and resolve problems. But in fact, while some projects do have many eyes on them, others have few or none at all. Growing reliance on open software means that it's time for industry and government to come together to establish baseline standards for security, maintenance, provenance, and testing.
Support it with money, for Christ's sake.
Exactly.
That's the problem. They use this stuff for free, and then they go, well, I see you.
Yeah, it's broken.
Support it.
To ensure national infrastructure, he said, and other important systems can rely on open source projects.
At least he's not saying only use proprietary, but it is Google after all. So.
Right. Yeah. Yes. These standards should be developed through a collaborative process with an emphasis on frequent updates, continuous testing, and verified integrity. Yes, wouldn't that be nice? If only, as you said, Leah, we had the money. So, yeah, this is nice to see, but for me at least, I have no idea how we would get from where we are today to there. The end of the White House's report suggested that the government's purchasing power could be and would be, used to bring about that change. What was written said, quote, President Biden has made software security a national priority. His executive... Okay, I'm going to just bite my tongue. His executive order on cybersecurity requires that only companies that use secure software development lifecycle practices and meet specific federal security guidance will be able to sell to the federal government for the first time. Okay.
Wow.
Leveraging the purchasing power of the federal government to drive improvements in the software supply chain, improvements that companies and governments around the world will benefit from. Yeah. Unquote. So if we had not been paying attention to the way things never seem to get done in Washington, that buying power statement might be encouraging. But it's just more bureaucracy. We know that our present system is far from perfect. It's a constant and necessary theme of this podcast. But efforts like Google's Project Zero, Trend Micro's Zero Day Initiative, HackerOne's bug bounty management, the Pwn2Own competitions, the annual Black Hat and DEF CON conferences, everyone contributing to Chromium, the academic research, and the occasional crowdsourced funding of intensive security audits of mission-critical packages. These are all existing, proven, and highly effective solutions within their own realms, which have all emerged organically. They have thrived year after year because they have been effective and they've made sense. If the U.S. government wants to help, its time would be better spent, I think, exactly as you said, Leo, in peeling off some taxpayer money, and not too much. You don't want to wreck the status quo. You know, you don't want to wreck all this by just throwing money at it and having it all go sideways. And put some additional funding behind these existing initiatives that are limited in what they can do due to lack of support for personnel or the size of bug bounty motivations. Back in 1965, the U.S. Congress created an independent agency known as the National Endowment for the Arts. It offers support and funding for projects exhibiting artistic excellence. Artists write proposals and apply for grants to receive funding. I'm all for change and for improving what we're doing, but we're also largely doing the right things now. Doing more of what we're already doing seems like a nearer-term solution that could be implemented today with a greater guarantee of results. A national endowment for the improvement of software quality, if properly administered, might be a worthy consideration.
Good.
So, yeah. Maybe.
Maybe.
Think about it.
Yeah. There's just so many open source projects that end up as part of commercial software, but nobody's paying for them. They're maintained by one guy's, volunteer. And that's kind of Log4j's story. But they're used as infrastructure. These companies need to kind of pony up and support this.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. That fabulous picture of the, not a house of cards, it's like a tower of crazy blocks with, down at the very bottom, one little toothpick-sized thing that's like holding up the whole crazy mess. and, you know, maintained thanklessly by some guy in Nebraska. You know, it's like, okay. Okay, speaking of software quality, last Tuesday was another of Microsoft's all-too-frequent mixed blessing patch Tuesdays. Okay, so first, here's the good news. A total of 97 vulnerabilities of varying severity were patched. And there were also an additional 29 vulnerabilities fixed in Microsoft's Edge browser. Of the 97 non-Edge vulnerabilities, 9 were classified as critical and the other 88 as important. Overall, the patches cover Windows and Windows components, Edge, Exchange Server, no surprise there, Office and Office's components, SharePoint Server, .NET Framework, Microsoft Dynamics, some open source software even, Hyper-V, Defender, and the Remote Desktop Protocol, RDP. Dustin Childs with Trend Micro's Zero Day Initiative said, "This is an unusually large update for January. Over the last few years, the average number of patches released in January is about half this volume. We'll see if this volume continues throughout the year. It's certainly a change from the smaller releases that ended 2021. Okay, so Microsoft patched 67 bugs last month in December. Now we're at 97. Okay. Now, Microsoft classes a zero-day vulnerability differently than we do here. My feeling is that we need to reserve the term zero-day, which has unfortunately taken hold as clickbait, for a vulnerability which is first discovered when it is observed being used in the wild. The point is that patching that puppy, which is currently being exploited, is much more important than patching a problem that's only potentially exploitable and which has been reported responsibly and privately, so nobody knows about it except the group that can fix it. But Microsoft also classifies vulnerabilities that have been irresponsibly and publicly disclosed as 0 days, and also regardless of how bad they are. So, like, you know, somebody discloses a vulnerability that, you know, has the pizza come out cold. Oh, that's a 0 day. Oh, okay.
That's a CVE of 10, baby. That's critical, man. Don't mess with that.
You know, but okay, so that's what Microsoft wants to call them. I can see their point, since the race is then on to get the world patched before the publicly disclosed vulnerability can be weaponized and actively deployed. So I accept their definition in this case. And that also means that a total of 6 unexploited but published 0 day vulnerabilities, as they want to call them, were also fixed last week. So overall, the breakdown by type was 41 elevation of privilege vulnerabilities. And we know those are bad once you gain a foothold. 29 remote code execution vulnerabilities, obviously never good. 9 security feature bypass vulnerabilities, which could be anything. 9 denial of service vulnerabilities, which mostly means it's easy to crash something. 6 information disclosure vulnerabilities, something leaks. And 3 spoofing vulnerabilities. Okay, and separately, those 6 unexploited but published 0 days, as they call them, which were patched, were, and remember there was a mention of open source, there was the open source curl remote code execution vulnerability. We'll look at that in a minute. It's not clear to me how that executes remote code. It's interestingly funky. But anyway, there's also a libarchive remote code execution vulnerability. Definitely looks like you could execute code with that one. Then 4, both of those are the 2 open source ones. Then we have Windows user profile service elevation or privilege, Windows certificate spoofing, Windows event tracing discretionary access control list, you know, DACL, D-A-C-L, denial of service, so that crashes something, and Windows Security Center API remote code execution. Okay. Those first 2, as I said, curl and libarchive, which are the only remote code execution problems among those 6, had already been fixed by their maintainers, but the fixes had not yet been incorporated into Windows until last Tuesday. So last Tuesday's Patch Tuesday updated Windows use of those, Windows inclusion of those. Now, reading the details of the curl problem, it's unclear, as I said, how it could like offer remote code execution. Here's what they said. When curl version greater than or equal to 7.20.0 and less than or equal to the one that fixed it, 7.78.0, connects to an IMAP or POP, so this is curl, connecting to an IMAP or POP3 email server to retrieve data using start TLS to upgrade the connection's TLS security, the server can respond and send back multiple responses at once that curl caches. Curl would then upgrade to TLS, but not flush the in-queue of cached responses. Instead, continue using and trusting the responses it got before the TLS handshake, as if they were authenticated. Using this flaw, it allows a man-in-the-middle attacker to first inject the fake responses, then pass through the TLS traffic from the legitimate server and trick curl into sending back data to the user under the assumption that the attacker's injected data comes from the TLS-protected server. Okay, so that's a cool hack, right? Somebody figured out that, you know, curl is going to want to elevate its security to TLS, assuming that the IMAP or POP3 server in the hello handshake indicated that it supports start TLS, and so that would happen. So this is a very subtle and clever bug that comes about as a side effect of the start TLS kludge, which is really what it was. You know, it was the original way of providing email encryption over the traditional SMTP, IMAP, and POP ports before they obtained their own dedicated TLS connection ports, which they have now. And it's exactly the sort of bug that tends to creep into systems that were being pushed to do things they were not originally designed to do, such as on-the-fly switching an unencrypted connection to using encryption. Okay, so that's the curl bug. And as I said, someone claimed that it could be used for remote code execution, though didn't explain in this disclosure how that could be so. Just looked like you could get some, you know, a bad guy, a man in the middle, could sneak some stuff in into an email client query that didn't actually come from the then authenticated server. But the Live Archive bug affecting versions 3.4.1 through 3.5.1 is a use after free flaw in its copy string function when called from either do uncompress block or process block. So that one might well be leveraged for remote code execution if a bad guy found some way to get the user or the system to use Live Archive to decompress a specially and maliciously formed archive. That one I believe. In any event, patching should not be postponed since many of these already do have proof of concept exploits published. Remember, they're Microsoft zero days. And as we often observe, attacks never get worse. They only ever get better. Mostly, though, compared to other things going on right now, this is certainly not a four-alarm fire. So, you know, not for that reason. Oh, and if you encountered some of last week's breathless, oh my God, patch now, Windows contains a wormable flaw press coverage, the reason I didn't lead with it is that for Windows IIS server to be vulnerable to it, which is what that breathless press coverage was about, requires enabling an obscure and non-default registry key. Under services, you know, current control set, services, HTTP parameters, you need to have, someone needs to have enabled something called enable trailer support and set that to 1. We're all familiar with the way HTTP headers work, where they form metadata such as cookie information, an asset's creation timestamp, probably its lifetime before expiration, you know, like, you know, how long the client is allowed to cache it before explicitly checking to see if it's been updated and so on. Well, it turns out that it's also possible, who knew, for additional headers, in this case called trailers, to be included after a chunked style encoded query or response. Just a few weeks ago, we clearly covered chunk styled encoding because that came up in something we were talking about. Okay, so you can have headers after the content? Okay, what? This really feels like the HTTP designers ran out of important work to do and sat around asking themselves, what else can we add? You know, and that never ends well. So they invented a previously unappreciated need, suggesting that it might be that a client or a server would not be able to fully form its query or response headers until after the body of the query or the response had been formed. No one knows why that might be true, but hey, it could happen. Remember that since the dawn of the web, this had never actually apparently been a problem. But perhaps they got their important work finished early, so they decided to define a solution for this one anyway. So yes, it turns out since HTTP 1.1, in addition to headers, it's also possible to have trailers. But as I said, Windows IIS Server does not have that feature turned on by default. And since no one actually uses trailers, it's unclear why anyone would have ever turned it on. But okay, until last Tuesday, if someone had actually turned it on, then yes, IIS could theoretically be exploited by leveraging some mishandling in its non-default enabled support for HTTP's unused and unnecessary trailers feature. Now, as for that flaw being wormable, it seems to me that requires somewhere for the worm to go. And if no one else running IIS has that unused and unneeded and disabled feature enabled, that's going to be one lonely wannabe worm desperately trying to propagate. Which kind of reminds me of my adolescence. Anyway, despite all of
not
this...
Not reproduce, propagate.
Despite all of this, since we all agree that worms are bad, and since the attack complexity is quite low, this non-threat earned itself a CVSS of 9.8. So that alone must be what the other tech press saw and thought, oh my God.
The pizza's going to be cold.
It is going to be a very cold pizza. Now, actually, I've been told cold pizza can be quite tasty.
It is. So it's an excellent breakfast treat.
Wasn't the best example to use. In any event, what was never a huge problem is no longer any problem. Well, it might be. That was Patch Tuesday's good news. Here's the other shoe. As ThreatPost headlined their coverage, Microsoft yanks buggy Windows server updates. So maybe there's hope for that worm after all. ThreatPost wrote, since their release on Patch Tuesday, the updates have been breaking Windows, causing spontaneous boot loops on Windows domain controller servers, breaking Hyper-V, and making the REFS volume systems unavailable. Whoa. Microsoft has yanked the Windows Server updates it issued on Patch Tuesday after admins found that the updates had critical bugs that broke those three things. People who were quite frustrated were venting all over Twitter. I saw one posting asking the question, does Microsoft even test these things before releasing them? There was actually a great deal of frustration. I heard about this directly from many of our listeners and Twitter followers. In addition, it's been confirmed that Tuesday's updates for Windows 10 desktop machines were also breaking L2TP VPN connections. They no longer worked. Bleeping Computer was tracking this saga day to day and blow by blow. On Thursday, they reported that Microsoft had pulled the January Windows Server cumulative updates and were no longer accessible via Windows Update. But as of that afternoon, Microsoft had reportedly not also pulled the Windows 10 and Windows 11 cumulative updates that were breaking L2TP VPN connections, and that was confirmed. So it's unclear how that went. This is all the mixed blessing of Windows updates recently. We're pushed to install them immediately with breathless, though in this instance unwarranted, warnings of the sky falling from a server worm. But installing these things through most of 2021 and continuing that trend into 2022 has resulted in the loss of mission-critical functionality. So, damned if you do, damned if you don't. Actually, don't appears the increasingly attractive option given Microsoft's recent side effect-laden updates. You know, let somebody else go there first, see if they survive, and if so, then cautiously follow. And Leo, we're not going to have to cautiously follow your advice about this next sponsor. I'm going to have some water while you tell us.
Okay, that's a bit of a stretch, but I'm glad you did it. This is actually something you all know all about and like a lot. One of our very first episodes, I think it was episode 2, was about honeypots.
Yay.
Of course, at the time, making a honeypot was a non-trivial task. We interviewed one of the creators of one of the very first, or not interviewed, he was on a panel in Boston with us for LastPass. Who was it? It was Steve, was it Steve Belevin? No. Anyway, he implemented a honeypot, I think, in the 60s. And then, of course, the honey monkeys that we were talking about in episode 2. Which is now 15 years ago almost, were also, you know, a little tricky to set up. Thank goodness, times have changed. We've come a long way, baby, and now you can have a honeypot. I got my own honeypot right here. It's my Thinkst Canary. This is a desirable object on the network that doesn't look vulnerable. It looks valuable. It looks like, well, whatever you want it to look like, a SCADA device or a Windows Server, or in this case, it's my network-attached storage. And it doesn't just look like one. It behaves in every respect like one. The MAC address is consistent. The interface is consistent. From the point of view of a bad guy, it looks like something on your network that he or she really wants to get into. This is the Thinkst Canary. It's brilliant. So easy to configure. So easy to set up. You just set it and forget it. It sits in your network. But here's the thing. If somebody breaches your network, if they use Log4j to get into your network, and then you close the barn door, yeah, you may say, well, now our network is safe from new intruders. But do you know if somebody's inside already? How do you know? Thinkst Canary. It's like the canary in the coal mine. It lets you know. The problem is companies usually find out too late that they've been breached, right? Even if they've spent millions of dollars on IT security, because nothing's perfect. You thought you were in great shape, and then Log4j came along. Attackers are sneaky. Once they get in, they lay low. They'll prowl around. They'll examine the network. They're looking for things they can export that might be valuable. They're looking for where you back up your data so they can make sure if they're using ransomware, it gets that as well as everything else. They're hunkered down and they're in there. On average, it takes, what was the number, 191 days for a company to realize there's an intruder on the network. That's 6+ months that somebody can wander around inside your network doing whatever they want. The problem is, as soon as they see the thing's canary and they try to log in, you know about them because you instantly get an alert. And I'm not talking about those avalanche of useless alerts. I mean, I'm talking an actionable alert you can do something with right away. You know, there's somebody just hit this network-attached storage with this login. They came in from IP address XYZ. They spent three. You get everything you need to know so that you can act and remediate. It can be on Active Directory. It can be registered as a device or a person on Active Directory. Oh, it can also serve files. They call them canary tokens. So I can create with this a bunch of PDFs, Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, anything I want. Well, that's what they look like. But when the hacker tries to open and examine them, immediately I'm notified. I just love this idea. Canaries can be deployed throughout your entire network. You can make them look like anything you want, a router, a switch, a NAS server, a Linux box, a Windows server. You can put fake files on them. You can name them in ways that gets the attention of a bad guy. When attackers investigate, they give themselves away. You're instantly notified. And by the way, notified exactly the way you want. With your canary, you'll get a console, but you also can get an email, a text message. You can do it through Slack. It supports webhooks, which means you pretty much do it anywhere. It supports syslog. They even have an API if you want to write a custom front end. You won't be inundated with false alarms, just the alerts that make a big difference. Canary was created by people who have trained companies, militaries, governments, how to break into networks. They really know exactly how it works. And with that knowledge, they built the best honeypot out there. You'll find canaries, they're deployed on all seven continents. One of the best tools against data breaches and a very affordable to boot. Now, I'll give you an idea of how this works out. You might want one or two canaries for a small business. Hundreds of some banks and casinos and places like that have hundreds of canaries all over. It's easy to manage. In fact, you even get a service contract. If anything goes wrong, if you sit on your canary, they'll send you a new one right away. Go to canary.tools/twit. As an example, let's say you want five canaries, $7,500 a year. You get that hosted console. You get free upgrade support and maintenance for that whole year. By the way, if you use the offer code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box, 10% off that price for life. So that's a very good deal. And because they know you might be listening to me and saying, well, I don't know, they offer a 2-month money-back guarantee for a full refund, and hardly anybody ever says, I don't like this. I want my money back. But if you do, if you feel that way, no questions asked, 2-month money-back guarantee. I think you're going to love your canary. If you go to canary.tools/love, you'll see all the love that people are bestowing upon canary. Go to canary.tools/twit to get yours. Don't forget the offer code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. Canary, the canary in the coal mine. canary.tools/twit. This is such a great idea. Everybody ought to have some canaries in their coal mine, if you know what I mean. Now, let's get back to Steve Gibson. Steve?
Okay, so this is important, and everybody gets to participate. Okay. this is not good. Okay, so the bottom line is, might be time once again to check for router firmware updates.
Gosh, darn.
But I know, but you can go to grc.sc and this episode number, grc.sc/854.
Yeah.
And that will tell you whether you're okay or not. And
maybe is it set up?
It should have given you more than that already.
Let me go directly. There we go.
There you go.
Probing my port, 20,005.
Yes.
Okay. That's not a port I'm familiar with.
Not a port anybody's familiar with. Okay. So the security. Yeah. Your stealth, good. The security research firm Sentinel One has discovered that some common code licensed by a number of prominent router manufacturers contains a highly critical, remotely exploitable flaw. Among the routers known to be affected are those by Netgear, TP-Link, Tenda, Edimax, D-Link, and Western Digital.
Holy cow.
I know. So here's what we know. They, or rather he, at Sentinel One, his name is Max, discovered a high-severity flaw in the what's known as the K-Codes is the company, K-Codes Net USB kernel module used by that large number of network device vendors and affecting millions of end-user router devices. This allows attackers to remotely exploit the vulnerability to execute code in the kernel. Sentinel Labs, Max's company, began the disclosure process last year on the 9th of September, and the patch was sent to licensee router vendors on the 4th of October. So it should be incorporated into router firmware updates by now. That's more than 90 days. At this time, Sentinel One has not discovered evidence of in-the-wild abuse. Okay, so here, in the author's voice, is how this all began. He said, as a number of my projects start, when I heard that Pwn2Own Mobile 2021 had been announced, I set about looking at one of the targets. Having not looked at the Netgear device when it appeared in the 2019 contest, I decided to give it a look over. While going through various paths through various binaries, I came across a kernel module called NetUSB. As it turned out, this module was listening on TCP port 20005 on the IP 0.0.0.0. Provided that there were no firewall rules in place to block it, and typical consumer routers don't have any, that would mean it was listening on the WAN as well as the LAN. He says, who wouldn't love a remote kernel bug? NetUSB is a product developed by K-Codes. It's designed to allow remote devices in a network to interact with USB devices connected to a router. For example, you could interact with a printer as though it is plugged directly into your computer via USB. This requires a driver on your computer that communicates with the router through this kernel module. But of course, you don't have to be using this to have it there, alive and running in your router, if it just has that NetUSB feature, which the router manufacturer licensed from K-Codes. Okay, he then proceeds to provide a detailed takedown description of his successful hunt for a critical vulnerability in the K-Code code. He discovered a dangerous switch function driven by a command type that's provided by the user. And the rest does not end well. I provided a link in the show notes for anyone who wants all the gory details. So it's insane. And it is so wrong that this buggy K-Code service is bound to the router's WAN interface. Essentially, 0.0.0.0 is all interfaces on the stack, as opposed to, you know, if it were bound to 192.168.0.1 or .1.1, that is bound to the gateway interface, then it would only be listening on local ports inside the LAN, which is what everyone wants. Nobody wants this thing listening on the WAN, but it turns out by default, it is. That means it is instantly discoverable by bad guys anywhere, and of course by Shodan. It also means that it's instantly testable, as we started out talking about, by any port probe. And I just happen to offer a free online port probing service. So the other link I provided is a grc.sc shortcut to instantly allow our listeners and anyone to check any router they're behind for this vulnerability. Open your browser and just put in grc.sc/854. This week's episode number. This will jump you to GRC's Shields Up custom port probe, preloaded to check port 20005. You'll see on your browser screen, it sends a bunch of TCP SYN packets spread out over a few seconds. I think it's 5 seconds. I send one every half second so as not to overload anything and to redundantly send TCP SYNs to make sure that we'll see if we get back a SYNAC. That will be sent to the IP address also shown on that page to quickly and privately check your browser's publicly exposed WAN interface to determine whether it's accepting incoming TCP connections over port 20005. It should not be. If it is, unplug it. I mean, really, unplug it. Or if you can, add a firewall rule, if your router allows you to explicitly block that port on the WAN interface until you're able to update your router's firmware. Hopefully, for an update is available. As I said, Max, who discovered and responsibly disclosed this and waited patiently for more than 90 days until last Tuesday, the 11th, before going public with it, finished his disclosure by writing, "This vulnerability affects millions of devices around the world, and in some instances may be completely remotely accessible. Due to the large number of vendors that are affected by the vulnerability, we reported this vulnerability directly to K-Codes to be distributed among their licensees instead of targeting just, for example, the TP-Link or the Netgear device in the contest. This ensures that all vendors receive the patch instead of just one during the contest. While we're not going to release any exploits for it, there is a chance that one may become public in the future, despite the rather significant complexity involved in developing one. We recommend that all users follow the remediation information above in order to reduce any potential risk." And we have another example of something good that came from the Pwn to Own competition. Now, let me just say, I did read in detail his posting. He did not develop an exploit, but he walked anybody who's competent right up to one. Also, this is because this is a common code across a large number of routers, all Linux-based. The tools are there for developing it. That means that if you create one exploit, you literally, you're getting millions of devices, which are trivial to find, and you're able to execute your own code on those all common Linux platforms. So it's not just one make and model. It's just not one make. It is cross-vendor. This is really going to be juicy.
Now, to be clear, if it says closed, are you okay? Instead of stealth, obviously yes, open's bad.
Open is the bad news. Closed is fine.
Oh, okay.
Closed is fine. All it means is that your router bounced back a no.
It responded. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Probably sent back a TCP reset saying, you know, I got your probe, but I'm not open for business. That's fine. Stealth is cooler. It just means that no response was returned. It's no one's business that there's even anything at that IP listening. Open is the danger.
And you can't do this from outside your house. You have to do it from within the network.
Correct. I did that. That's clearly the design intent of Shields Up, because otherwise it would allow bad people to probe other people's IPs.
Not good.
And
yeah.
That would have been not good. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've got to do it, you know, from the LAN, which you want to verify. But just again, this is not a small thing. Let me please encourage our listeners, grc.sc/854. If you're at work and you've got, a family member or kids are at home, give them a call. Have them do this. You definitely want this thing. There's no way this is not going to be exploited. There's no way, because it's Linux, because it's cross router vendor. There's just no way this is not going to end up getting exploited. Okay. Chrome is going to be limiting its access to private networks, and this is a win and a half. It will soon be implementing probably the first of the Chromium. We can hope that Safari and Firefox follow. A newly proposed web standard, which is known as Private Network Access, or PNA. If anyone's interested, I've got a it's a W3 standard, just like I think it was January 2nd was the date on this, so the ink is not dry, or the HTML not yet set. I've got a link in the show notes. It will apply new and welcome, in my opinion, controls to block external internet websites from querying and interacting with devices and servers located inside local private networks. And we've talked about this problem a number of times already. As I mentioned, this change will occur as Chrome implements this new W3C spec known as Private Network Access. It'll be rolled out in the first half of the year for Chrome. PNA adds a mechanism through which external internet sites must first ask systems inside local networks for explicit permission before being allowed to have any sort of connection. Okay, now, that's what some of the coverage says, and it's not exactly the way this works. What happens is Chrome will notice when an external internet-based server is doing something that requires internal access, and then Chrome will take responsibility for saying, wait a minute, let's see if that's okay. Okay, so Chrome and any other PNA-compliant browsers will first send what's known as a CORS pre-flight request. CORS is cross-origin resource sharing, a nice addition to the web standard for controlling who gets to talk to who cross-origin. So Chrome will first send this what's known as a CORS pre-flight request to the local server or service, whatever it is, on the LAN, before granting any internet originating request for a private network resource. This CORS request will ask for and needs to obtain explicit permission from the internal target server or service. The pre-flight request, which is just a fancy name for an extra header, is a new header. It is access-control-request-private-networks. Access control request private network colon true is what Chrome sends out. And the response to it must also contain a header access control allow private network colon true. If the targeted local devices, such as servers or routers, fail to respond, internet websites will be blocked from connecting, as they never should probably be allowed to anyway. I can't imagine why that, like what that's used for. Maybe there is a legitimate use. We know it's been exploited a lot. So this is a wonderful improvement in cross-origin access control. As we know, and have devoted a number of podcasts to explaining, bad guys have figured out that they can use a browser as a proxy to relay connections to an individual's or a company's internal network. For example, a malicious website could contain code that tries to access an IP address like 192.168.0.1, which will often display the router's the LAN router's local admin logon page, which is only accessible by design from the router's LAN interface. But because the request is coming from the user's browser on the LAN, the router assumes that the user wants to log in. So as we've seen, when unwitting users access a malicious site, it's been possible to induce their browser to make a request to their router without their knowledge. This can send malicious code to bypass the router's authentication and modify router settings. It's happened. Variations of these internet-to-local network attacks could also target other local systems, such as internal servers, domain controllers, firewalls, or even locally hosted applications. So by introducing the PNA specification inside Chrome and within Chrome's permission negotiation system, Google will be moving to prevent such automated attacks. And I say yay. According to Google, a version of PNA has already been slipped into and shipped with Chrome 96, which was released back last November. But full support will be rolled out in two phases this year, with Chrome 98 in early March and Chrome 101 scheduled for late May. In this coming March's Chrome 98, Chrome will begin sending these pre-flight requests ahead of private network sub-resource requests. These pre-flight failures will only display warnings in the dev tools of the browser without otherwise affecting the private network requests. So they remain allowed and unblocked. So this, you know, this gives devs who are wanting to bring up support for this affirmative information about the fact that this is going on. Chrome gathers compatibility data and reaches out to the largest affected websites. So Chrome will be using this for instrumenting their own research. And if it turns out that there are, you know, major websites doing this, they'll notify them that, hey, you know, this is going to start getting blocked here before long. Google expects this to be broadly compatible with existing websites. And, you know, yeah, why wouldn't it be? It doesn't break anything yet. Then, no earlier than late May's scheduled Chrome 101. Assuming that established compatibility data indicates that the change will be safe enough and that sufficient outreach has successfully occurred, Chrome will begin enforcing that pre-flight requests must succeed, and it will otherwise fail those externally sourced requests. They said a deprecation trial will start at the same time to allow for websites affected by this phase to request a time extension. The trial will last for at least 6 months. So, you know, the concern that's evidence here is that, as is always the case, tightening up security may break something that was happening, you know, little known and unseen in the background. But overall, this is a welcome improvement. If there is something on the LAN that really does intentionally wish to be able to receive and respond to requests originating from the user's browser, but triggered from an outside, an external source, then, you know, such devices will need to be updated with an awareness of these new forthcoming PNA controls. And that simply entails replying with the newly added header to continue enabling what had always been allowed before. So not a big change to make, easy to do. And I just think this is a big, useful step forward. So yay to... And actually, it was a couple of Google guys who apparently were responsible for getting this thing through the W3C. So props to them. Just finished with three high severity flaws, you know, just mentioning them in WordPress. As I mentioned at the top of the show, as a consequence of these three, 84,000 WordPress-based websites are affected, and they're very serious. The guys at WordFence titled their disclosure, 84,000 WordPress sites affected by three plugins with the same vulnerability. They wrote on November 5th, 2021, so, you know, November of last year, the WordFence threat intelligence team initiated the responsible disclosure process for a vulnerability we discovered in login/signup pop-up. A WordPress plugin that is installed on over 20,000 sites. A few days later, we discovered the same vulnerability present in two additional plugins developed by the same author. Sidecart WooCommerce, installed on over 60,000 sites, and Waitlist WooCommerce, the back-in-stock notifier, which is installed on over 4,000 sites. This flaw made it possible for an attacker to update arbitrary site options on a vulnerable site, provided that they could trick a site's admin into performing an action, such as clicking on a link. They said, "We sent full disclosure details on November 5th, 2021, after the developer confirmed the appropriate channel to handle their communications. After several follow-ups, a patched version of login sign-up pop-up was released on November 24th, while patched versions of Sidecart WooCommerce and Waitlist WooCommerce were released on December 17th. So they waited 90 days again, and now they're, well, not December, yeah, not in that case, but, you know, they gave time to get these things pushed out and updated. They said, "We strongly recommend ensuring that your site has been updated to the latest patched version of any of these plugins, which is version 2.3 for login / signup pop-up, version 2.5.2 for Waitlist WooCommerce, and version 2.1 for the Sidecart WooCommerce at the time of the publication." So anyway, just a heads up, it's, you know, when I hear that something like WooCommerce is running on WordPress, wow, you know, we hear about commerce sites being attacked all the time, and WordPress is not a place you want to do something that is really security sensitive. You know, blogs and comment scrolls and comment threads, that's one thing. But more than that, I don't know. Okay, a couple closing the loop pieces. Pete Morelli said, "Expanse season complete. You'll love it." So I just wanted to note to our listeners who are interested, if you've been waiting before you jump on the final season of Expanse, I have been waiting. So, Peter, thank you for that. I want to let everybody know. Chris Miles, or Milesy, he said, "Steve, have you guys seen the huge QNAP vulnerability that has ended up with hundreds of thousands of units infected with ransomware code? Even a unit of mine with strong passwords was hit. Thankfully, one-way versioned backups meant nothing was lost." So, and I wanted to take this opportunity. Thank you, Chris, for the heads up. I keep trying to get to it in the show, but there's been so much else to talk about. You know, we've said before, there is available non-QNAP open source software that looks like it does a much better job. QNAP just perennially seems unable to get their act together here. They've had one serious remote code execution problem after another. So at some point, just, you know, go find the, I don't remember if it's FreeBSD based or OpenBSD or what it is, but it's one of them that you can run on the QNAP system in order to do network attached storage features, and just get away from QNAP's solution. Hardware, yes. Software, apparently not. Okay, two listeners via DM. So I didn't put their name in since DM is inherently private, and I wasn't sure they wanted me to disclose who they were. First one said, "Hi, Steve. I was intrigued by your mention of refilling SodaStream bottles in last week's SN 853. I use SodaStream a lot to replace buying soda," he says, parens called sparkling water here in the oh-so-pretentious UK, he said, "in plastic bottles, but the refills, meaning of SodaStream, are expensive. Do you refill from brewing gas bottles or some other source?" And listener two, "Hi, Steve. Would you be so kind as to share the link to the SodaStream refill adapter you're using? I would very much appreciate it. And of course, I will keep this confidential." I apparently will not, although I did keep his name confidential. So anyway, for those who don't know, this all this interest was stirred up by Leo and me talking about the fact that I have been for years refilling my empty soda stream, you know, steel CO2 canisters. For a while, I was taking them to my local, Ace Hardware was a provider. You know, they talk about how easy it is to swap the canisters. Well, you take your empties back, and it may be easy, but it sure ain't inexpensive. And after a while, I don't know how it occurred to me, but I thought, you know, I wonder if there's a way to refill these. So a little bit of Googling, sure enough. There is a common source of food grade CO2. You want to make sure you get, like, you know, food grade everything. And that's people who do home brewing. It turns out about a mile from me is a nice little home brewing retailer on Bristol Avenue in Costa Mesa. And I guess it's more than a mile, but still, it's convenient. And home brewing people use CO2. And so on Amazon, I purchased first a 20-pound CO2 canister with a siphon. That's important. The siphon is a key, unless you want to have your big canister upside down. The siphon just, it's just a little a little tube that runs down to the bottom of the tank, so that it's pulling liquid CO2 from the bottom out the spigot, as opposed to taking the gas off the top. So you get that. That's $150 if you're interested. And then a refill adapter is nothing but a cleverly simple threaded, it's female threads on both sides. So you screw one end, it's got the proper threads for the standard CO2 connection. And then on the side that's facing outward is the threading that matches the universal SodaStream bottles. And so basically all this does is it just mates a now empty SodaStream bottle to the liquid CO2 filled big 20-pound refillable at your local source of CO2 bottle. Now
I would just caution people, because I did this, bought all this. And I'm still looking, but Russell, who is a home brewer, says he has, it used to be he could bring his bottles in and they would fill it. Now they exchange them at the places he's gone, or they, for some crap dented up bottle, or they require this whole testing process before they'll do it. They say, leave it here and you can come back tomorrow, that kind of thing. So I would check before you jump whole hog into this to make sure you do have a good source of CO2 that you can use to refill it. You know, call
Very
around.
Good.
Because apparently, good, you know, and I'm not surprised. These guys, they're kind of, maybe because of COVID, they're tired of dealing with people. I don't know. It's getting maybe a little harder to get these filled.
That's interesting. I've
You're lucky. You got somebody who can do it.
Yeah, I and they're nice people, and they're, you know,
bring them candy. To see me and- yeah, exactly. They like you now, so they trust you. Yeah.
So I thought I would share a couple pointers, and then we won't talk about this again. First is you absolutely want your SodaStream empty canister frozen. That is, what we do is we have like a spare freezer, and so it's got our empties in there. So you want to refill them when they're cold. That minimizes the re-expansion of the liquid CO2, and you get a much fuller bottle. The second is that the top of the SodaStream, basically it's got a little push valve that when you push the SodaStream down, a pin pushes down in the center in order to release the compressed CO2.
They charge so much money for what is essentially a mechanical lever, a plastic thing with a mechanical lever, because all it's doing is pushing down the button, and it goes in the spout, and it goes in your soda pop.
that's right. However, the one gotcha here is that if that is pushed too far in, it stops again. So the trick of refilling these is to bleed it in. If you hook everything up and just open the main valve, nothing happens. You'll hear like, eh, and then it's like stopped. So what I've learned is, first of all, cool the receiving canister, and then just ever so slightly twist the valve open, and you'll hear the sound of gas or fluid flowing. That's all you need to do. Walk away, as I mentioned jokingly, but actually sincerely last week. Don't stand directly in front of it.
At crotch height.
Yeah, it is at crotch height.
It could impede your propagating, so don't do that. Yeah,
that would limit even practicing.
Yeah.
Yes. So. And it takes, a couple minutes. And if it slows down, then you can, creep the valve open again and, restart the little sound. But boy, it's just so gratifying when you're unable to put any more in, you turn off the main valve, remove the cylinder. It is heavy because it is now filled with liquid CO2, and then you're good to go for a whole long. And I think I paid $14 to have this 20-pound big, floor standing canister refilled, which, beats the hell out of, going and buying new canisters from, because we love SodaStream.
The idea is to save money in the long run anyway. So, yeah. And to eliminate single-use plastic bottles.
Yes.
That's exactly. Why we got it, yeah.
Sunday evening, night before last, after a weekend spent scratching my head and experimenting with an older motherboard, which I had purchased through eBay in order to duplicate what at least one of our testers had seen, I figured out what was going on and adjusted Spinrite's core technology to accommodate it and any other similar systems. The trouble I had been having was occurring due to Intel's 82371 PCI to ISA / IDE accelerator, as they call it. It's known as the PIIX4, and the chip's spec is dated April of 1997. So, yeah. Getting this version 6.1 release of Spinrite to run everywhere is turning out to be far more work, and I'm not surprised, since the whole point of 6.1 is to bypass the BIOS and talk directly to the hardware. The BIOS may not have been, terrific for performance. It did not have performance on its side, but it does have compatibility. I knew that this was likely to be where a lot of time was going to be spent. Fortunately, we have a really amazing group of development testers. The instance of GitLab that I brought up in mid-December currently has 241 registered participants. So, by far, most of them watch and silently test the code as it evolves. If it does something wrong, then I'll hear about it. But it's very gratifying to know that Spinrite is receiving this level of pounding at this stage. Yesterday, or day before yesterday, rather, in that end of the weekend's work update, I posted to the news groups. I said, I think that with the Supermicro, the ASUS EEE PC901, and now MilQ's 82371 chip issues all resolved, that's the last of the big mystery behavior problems. This just leaves me with a bunch of less interesting and already understood things to fix and clean up. Once those are finished, I think we'll be ready to thoroughly pound on what we have to see whether anything else falls off. It feels like we're getting close to having this operational foundation fully functional. So that will be a major milestone. We will get to a point where the code I have is identifying every drive that everybody has connected using every controller on every system they have correctly, and running benchmarks on those to demonstrate that it, you know, it, it's able to talk to the drive. And part of that is a read-write test, which I perform way out at the far end of the drive. And at that point, it's just time to basically finish SpinWrite. That is, all of this hardware compatibility layer will be resolved, and I get to move forward, you know, update the screens for to hold larger numbers and that kind of thing. So it'll be a nice milestone to get to. And, you know, we're probably within a week or two of that. So, yay. And Leo?
Time to break?
Is that final break? Coming? And then we're going to look at the anatomy of a Log4j exploit.
Awesome.
What did those evil, in this case, because they're hackers and attackers, Iranians do?
Evildoers.
Evildoers.
I want to talk about Collide, because I think this is a really good idea for endpoint management. Now, you maybe are aware of Apple's MDM solution, which locks down employees' devices, their smartphones, things like that, without considering their needs or even attempting to educate them about the security of their laptop. MDM is widely used, mobile device management. Collide's a better way, a much better way, a collaborative way, a way your employees will like, or your customers, or your clients will like, in a way you'll like too. Because Collide, K-O-L-I-D-E, is built by like-minded security practitioners who have seen in the past just how much MDM was disrupting end users, frustrating them so badly they throw up their hands, forget, you know, all right, I'm using my own laptop, right? I'm not using this. This isn't ridiculous. I hear that story a lot. Without telling anyone, and of course, opening you up to all sorts of problems. In that scenario, in which everybody loses, the user and you and your business and everything. Collide is different. Instead of locking down a device, I really like this. Collide takes a user-focused approach that communicates security recommendations to your employees directly on Slack. So after Collide's set up, in fact, I'm sure Russell wants to use this because we use Slack. Device security turns from this, you know, on or off police state, basically, into a dynamic conversation. The conversation starts with the users installing the endpoint agent on their own. So they're already kind of empowered, right? We don't deliver this to you locked down. We say, here, install Collide through a guided process that happens right inside their first Slack message. From there, Collide regularly sends employees recommendations, suggestions, if you will, when it notices their device is in an insecure state, ranging from, you know, simple things like your screen lock is not set up correctly or doesn't come on or there's no password to turn it off, that kind of thing, to somewhat more nuanced, maybe even difficult to solve issues like, you know, suggesting people secure two-factor backup codes sitting in their download folder. You know, that's probably not a... It can't see post-it notes on the screen, but that's the next worst thing. And because it's talking directly to employees, Collide is educating them about the company's policies and how to best keep their devices secure using real examples, right? You know, from this is what's actually happening, not some theory. Plus, they feel listened to and engaged. And honestly, they're more likely to become a partner in security rather than fighting it every step of the way. Collide, Linux, Mac, or Windows, cross-platform endpoint management. It puts end users first, but make sure your security is taken care of. And it's, of course, for Teams to Slack. Get endpoint management that puts a user first, Collide, KOLIDE.com/twit. To learn more, you can activate a 14-day free trial today. No credit card needed. So I like that when they do that. That really, you know, that makes me feel better. K-O-L-I-D-E, collide.com/twit. If you're looking to a better alternative to MDM that doesn't make users feel like children, locked down, doesn't encourage them to try to go around your MDM, this is a really good solution. And I think it works really well. Collide, KOLIDE.com/twit. I think you'll be impressed. Give it a try anyway. Collide.com/twit. Now, I see the SodaStream bottle.
That was my SodaStream bottle I was drinking from. Yep.
I see. See Steve's SodaStream. And of course, he has the world's largest SodaStream bottle, just like everything else.
Okay, so many security firms are tracking threat actors who immediately and predictably jumped aboard the Log4j bandwagon. You know, it's been a feeding frenzy for the security firms. To help bring this home and make it a bit more real, I wanted to share a piece of Check Point Research's reverse engineering work on a typical threat the internet is now facing. I've got, for anyone who wants more detail, as always, a link in the show notes. Last week, Check Point documented the efforts of an Iranian government-backed group known, again, not just Iranians, Iranian government-backed group known as APT-35, also known as Charming Kitten, TA-453, and Phosphorus. This group started widespread scanning and attempts to leverage the Log4j flaw in publicly facing systems only 4 days after the vulnerability was disclosed. And, you know, all the bad guys knew now that this was public, it was, you know, it was going to get remediated at some speed. The point being, let's be first, you know, get in there before that gets before the back doors get closed. Since this particular actor's setup was hurried, they simply grabbed one of the publicly available open source GitHub hosted JNDI exploit kits. Yes, they were on GitHub initially, but that kit has been removed from GitHub due to its enormous popularity following the vulnerability emergence. You know, why bother reinventing that particular wheel when time is of the essence? They also based their operations upon their pre-existing infrastructure rather than like creating a whole new one. And that infrastructure was already well known to Check Point, thus making its detection and attribution all the easier. In the show notes, I have a flowchart which shows the path that the exploit takes. And it could hardly be any easier or direct. First, the attackers send a crafted request to the victim's publicly facing internet exposed resource, whatever it is, a server of some sort. In this particular case, the weaponized payload was sent in through either the user agent or the HTTP authorization headers. Remember that all that needs to happen is that something somewhere that's Java-based logs part of the query that contains this weaponized string. In order to log the query, Log4j examines what it's logging, sees a JNDI component, and goes about its job of obtaining the content from the LDAP URL contained in the query, which is being logged. So the vulnerable machine, as it's been instructed to do, basically, although not after it's been patched, but until then, reaches out to a what they labeled in their diagram a Log4j exploitation server, which assembles the and returns a malicious Java class, which will be executed on the vulnerable machine. The class runs a PowerShell command with a Base64 encoded payload. And I actually have a picture of the actual payload, the exploit dot command, PowerShell, and then the encoded payload. That PowerShell command downloads a PowerShell module from an Amazon S3 bucket URL, and it actually is http://  s3.amazonaws.com/doc-library-sales/test.txt and executes it. And we have a picture of that in the show notes, the actual thing that's downloaded. The downloaded PowerShell payload is the main module that's then responsible for basic communication with the command and control server and the execution of additional modules which may be received. So the main module performs the following operations. It validates the network connection. Upon execution, the script waits for an active internet connection by repetitively making HTTP post requests to google.com with the parameter hi equals hi, just to see if it can succeed. That's how it detects whether or not it's got an internet connection. Assuming that it does, then it knows that. It also performs basic system enumeration. It collects the Windows OS version, the computer's name, and the contents of a file, ni.txt, in app data, in the app data path. The file is presumably created and filled by different modules that will be downloaded by the main module. It then retrieves the command and control server's domain. The malware decodes the command and control domain retrieved from a hard-coded URL located in the same S3 bucket from where that backdoor was downloaded. So the bad guys have dynamic control over that by deciding what goes in this AWS bucket. It also retrieves, decrypts, and executes follow-up modules. Okay, so once all the data is gathered, the malware starts communication with the command and control server at the domain, which it determined by pulling that from the Amazon AWS cloud bucket. And it does that. It communicates with the command and control server by periodically sending HTTP post requests. I mean, none of this is high tech. None of this is rocket science. You know, this is easy to do, which is why this terrified everybody so much. So this thing sends HTTP post requests to a pre-configured URL with each post request containing information from which to build a session key, the OS version, the computer's name, and the contents of that file in the app data directory. So that ends up being something unique, which it uses to identify itself each time. And I think, as I recall, it puts it in a session header in the post query. In response to the command and control servers receiving these post requests, it can either choose not to respond, in which case the script will keep sending post requests periodically to continue to provide the server with a stream of response opportunities, or the server will return a base64 encoded string. Now, just as a reminder, base64 is a means for sending binary data over an ASCII channel, that is, over a text-only channel. Groups of 3 8-bit binary bytes, so 3 8-bit binary bytes is 24 bits, they're regrouped from 3 8-bit bytes to 4 6-bit bytes. 6 bits can have 64 combinations. So we take the lower and the upper alphabet, gives us 2 times 26 characters, or 52 characters. We add the 10 decimal digits, that brings us up to 62 characters. And then we toss in 2 additional ones, the plus and the forward slash, which brings us to 64. So in groups of 3, binary is taken from the source binary. Those 24 bits are regrouped into 4 characters, each one of 64 different possibilities. That's then all munged back together and sent down to the client, which reverses the encoding process to restore the original binary. This allows the malicious server to squirt anything it wants into the victim machine that's making the queries. The modules downloaded in this fashion are either PowerShell or C# scripts. The modules sent by the command and control server are executed by the main module, with each one reporting data back to the server separately. So that the original module comes in, looks around, sets up shop, figures out who to talk to, initiates the dialogue and does that periodically. If in response to one of its multiple post queries, it receives a blob of base 64, it goes, oh, okay, something to do. It decodes it back into whatever it was before, you know, removes the base 64 encoding. We know that that's going to be a PowerShell or a C# script and runs it. At that point, that subsidiary module takes off on its own, and it establishes its own communication directly with the command and control server. The command and control cycle continues indefinitely, which allows the threat actors to gather data on the infected machine, run arbitrary commands, and possibly escalate their actions by performing a lateral movement or executing follow-up malware such as ransomware. In other words, you know, this thing can do anything it wants to once it gains a foothold. So, the modules. Every module is auto-generated by the attackers based on the data sent by the main module. Each of the modules contains a hard-coded machine name and a hard-coded CNC domain. Every module checkpoint observed contained a block of shared code, which makes sense because there's a bunch of stuff that they're all going to do regardless of their specific function. And that is encrypting the data to be sent, exfiltrating the gathered data through a post request or uploading it to an FTP server, that also happens, and sending execution logs to a remote server. In addition to this, each module performs one specific job. That is, in addition to those things they all have in common, Checkpoint retrieved and analyzed modules for six different functions. Listing installed applications, that is, applications installed on the machine, taking screenshots, listing the running processes, getting OS and computer information, executing a predefined command from the command and control server, and then finally, cleaning up any traces created by any of the other modules. The applications module uses two methods to fetch and return a list of installed modules. It can either enumerate the uninstall registry values or use the management the Windows Management Instrumentation command in order to get an enumeration. It gets those, encrypts them, and sends them back to headquarters. The screenshot module, they found both C# and PowerShell scripts for the screenshot. They both have the capability to capture multiple screenshots at specified intervals and upload the resulting screenshots to an FTP server whose credentials are provided by the script. The C# script uses a base 64 encoded PowerShell command to take the screenshot from multiple screens. So again, you might have this thing in your computer, not know it, you're doing things, and this thing is spying on you, sending shots of your screens back to headquarters. The processes module obtains a list of the machine's running processes using the task list command, gathers them, encodes them, sends them back. The system information module contains a bunch of PowerShell commands. What was interesting was that in the instances that Checkpoint saw, the bad guys had commented out all of these potential sources of information. They just weren't using it. This told Checkpoint that this whole campaign was hastily assembled since the entire as we know, attacker community was well aware that systems would be closing their doors very quickly. So there was like all these different suggestions of, you know, the moment this thing went public, the attackers jumped on it and said, let's quickly get something together that we can exploit this with. And finally, we have the command execution module, which is able to essentially download and execute any actions, any commands that are provided by the command and control server. They saw, for example, listing the contents of the C drive root, listing the specific Wi-Fi profile details using NetSH, the WLAN subcommand of that, and also listing all the drives using getPS drive, a PowerShell enumerator. And finally, the cleanup module. It's dropped after the attackers have finished their activity and want to remove any traces that they've been inside the system. The module contains cleanup methods for persistence-related artifacts in the registry and the startup folder, any files created, and any running processes. It contains five hard-coded levels of sort of like stages of cleanup, depending upon the stage of the attack, each one serving a different purpose. Checkpoint said that the design and the intent of the cleanup module made it clear that the threat actors want to keep the infection on the machine, first of all, for as long as they deem necessary, but then after, once their goal has been achieved, they want to disappear without a trace, so that, you know, no one believes that an attack occurred. As for attribution, of course, we know attribution of network remote attacks often falls somewhere between difficult to impossible, but not so in this case. Most advanced persistent threat actors put some effort into making sure to change their tools and their infrastructure to avoid being detected in the first place, and to make attribution much more difficult if they were detected. And in fact, we know that the SolarWinds attacks were famous for like really working to obscure the path by which the infection happened if it were to be discovered. However, APT-35 does not conform to this behavior. Apparently, the group is famous within the cybersecurity community for the number of operational security mistakes they've made in previous operations, and they tend not to put too much effort into changing their infrastructure once it's been exposed. So it's little wonder that their operation, as Checkpoint has detailed it, has significant overlaps in the code and the infrastructure which previously identified the activities of APT-35. As for code overlaps, 4 months ago, in October of 2021, Google's TAG team, remember their threat analysis group, published an article about APT-35's mobile malware, because Google and Android. Even though the samples Checkpoint analyzed were PowerShell scripts, the similar meaning, PowerShell as opposed to Android, so Windows only, the similarity of coding style between them and the Android spyware that Google attributed to APT-35 immediately caught Checkpoint's attention. For one thing, the implementation of the logging functions was identical between the Android app, which Google analyzed, and this present campaign's PowerShell modules, which use the identical logging format, even though the commands are commented out and replaced with another format. The fact that these lines were not removed outright, Checkpoint felt, might indicate that the change was done only recently. And the syntax of the logging messages themselves being logged is identical. As for infrastructure, both then and now campaigns, October and now, apparently use the same server-side infrastructure. When a client posts data to a remote HTTP server, the server-side path of the query is called the API endpoint. Google's mobile analysis and Checkpoint's both revealed the use of the common endpoint /API/session. Now, okay, that's not a high entropy name. Could have just been a collision of convenience. But Checkpoint felt encouraged by the observed overlap, and they stated in their report that other API endpoints are similar but not entirely identical due to the differences in the functionality of the platform. So it didn't make sense for them to be completely identical. Checkpoint also observed that not only are the URLs familiar, but the command and control domain of the PowerShell variant responds to the API requests that are used in the mobile variant. This suggests similar, if not identical, server-side support for both campaigns. So Checkpoint concluded its report by observing that every time there's a new published critical vulnerability, the entire InfoSec community holds its collective breath until its worst fears come true. Scenarios of real-world exploitation appear, especially by state-sponsored actors. As they demonstrated in their report, the breath-holding wait in the case of the Log4j vulnerability was only a few days. The combination of its simplicity, its publicly available open-source code samples, and the massively tantalizing number of vulnerable devices made this a very attractive vulnerability for actors such as APT35, and I have no doubt that, while I don't think I will continue giving this in-depth coverage because we know pretty much everything there is to know about it, well, if something major happens, it'll certainly be newsworthy. But that's how this stuff works. Again, it's frightening how non-rocket science, how script kiddie level this thing is, and that it can get up to so much mischief.
Amazing. Even a kitty? What kind of kitty? Charming kitten? Even a charming kitten can do it. Who comes up? Is that like a vulnonym? Who comes up with, there's Fancy Bear for the Russian group, Charming Kitten for the Iranian group. Somebody's coming up with these. Must be the CIA or the NSA. That's just wild. Steve, you did it again. Here we are at the end of another fabulous episode. If you would like to know more, Steve has the show notes at his website. It's not all that's there. There's a lot of stuff at grc.com, including that Shields Up test where you can test your port 22,009. What was it?
Please do. 20,005.
20,005.
And so it's grc.sc/our episode number, 854.
Okay. Every time I set up a new router or a new network, I use Shields Up to check, make sure it's properly configured. It's a very useful tool. One of many things Steve gives away. The only thing he doesn't, that's his very bread and butter SpinRite, his very, very popular mass storage maintenance and recovery utility. If you don't have a copy, you really ought to have one. If you get 6.0, the current version right now, you get a free upgrade to 6.1. It's imminent. You can help in the development of it as well. There's a forum there. All of that at grc.com. 16 kilobit versions of this show audio, as well as 64 kilobit audio versions of the show are there. The transcripts, which are very handy if you like to read while you listen, or just to search through to find a particular part of any given show. All at grc.com and lots of other stuff as well. We have 64 kilobit audio versions and full video as well, if you want to watch, available at our site, twit.tv/SN. There's a YouTube channel dedicated to security now. All the videos all the time. You can also subscribe in your favorite podcast player, because it is a podcast, and download it automatically. Or even go to the website, twit.tv/SN, and download it from there. If you subscribe in a podcast player, you get it automatically, which is probably a good idea, because this is one of those shows where I think you want all the episodes, right? You can go back at the website to episode one and come forward from there. The feeds only have the last 10 episodes for reasons of economy, but that'll get you started anyway. So look for Security Now on your favorite podcast player. If you want to watch us do the show live, we stream live at live.twit.tv 24/7. This show is every Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 21:30 UTC. You can watch live, listen live, chat live at irc.twit.tv or in the Club Twit Discord server, which is always a lot of fun to be in there. And I think that pretty much covers it all. We'll be back next Tuesday with another thrilling, gripping edition of Where the Hackers Are.
Righto.
Thanks, Steve. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, buddy.
Hey, you don't have to wait to the weekend to get the tech news you need. Join Jason Howell and myself, Micah Sargent, for Tech News Weekly, where we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. Security Now.